What I'm going to do this morning is I'm mainly going to talk about freedom's counterfeits, okay? And then this afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what it would actually be to be free, okay? Another sort of prefatory note about this paper, this lecture, is this is, you know, sort of a distillation of a larger work, which we always say when we're hedging, which is basically an attempt to mediate a conversation between a philosopher named Robert Brandom, who's at the University of Pittsburgh, and Alistair McIntyre, who maybe many of you heard of at Notre Dame. But I'm assuming that the Brandom stuff would be very foreign to most of you, so I've dropped all the quotations from Brandom out, and I just sort of summarize it. And I just want to note that, because if this were ever to fall into Bob Brandom's hands, I just want to note that I know it's your stuff. So, all right, here we go. All right, I take it that we are not entirely interested in the notion of freedom of the will for its own sake, for mostly because of its implications, but mostly because of its implications for our understanding of ourselves as responsible for our actions, and therefore as subject to some kind of moral or ethical evaluation. We see ourselves as capable of ethically significant actions, that is, those doings for which we might laud or shame people. And in this way, we honor or scorn our and other people's actions in a way that we do not appraise the doings of non-human animals or occurrences among inanimate beings. That is not to deny that we evaluate such doings or occurrences at all. One might rightly conclude that a bit of hunting by his pet chameleon was particularly magnificent, or that the destructive movements of a certain tornado were extraordinarily terrible. I live in Kansas and I have a chameleon, so you can show me my cards there. The difference between our attitudes towards the ethically significant actions of human beings and non-ethical doings and occurrences of chameleons and tornadoes is that we do not, in our reflective moments or when we're not waxing poetic, hold chameleons and tornadoes responsible for their doings and occurrences in the same way that we would hold ourselves accountable for our actions. Whatever might have happened in the curious case of Job, we are not perfectly serious in calling the whirlwind to account for its destructiveness, and I'm not quite doing the same thing when I congratulate my son Cormac on some feat as when I do so for our pet chameleon. Humans, at least, those among us who have achieved a certain level of maturity, are responsible for their doings in a way that renders those actions subject to a special kind of normative evaluation. In the standard debate about freedom of the will currently abroad, it is assumed that this distinctively human responsibility must be explained in terms of a more basic activity, an act of the will. That is, ethically significant action supposedly must, in one way or another, be caused by the will of an agent who performs such actions. For example, if Cormac is to be praised for having acted in such and such a way, then Cormac must have willed to have acted in that manner. And likewise, if Cormac is to be shamed for having acted in such and such a way, then Cormac must have willed to have acted in that manner. It seems pretty odd to us to praise or blame Cormac for having done something he had no intention of doing. That is the very difference between an action and an accident. Chameleons, of course, do not hunt accidentally, and there is a sense in which the destructiveness of tornadoes is not merely accidental, inasmuch as we can see it as subject to a certain law-governed explanation. Nevertheless, there is a kind of control we have over our actions that non-human animals and inanimate movers lack. In some sense, what Cormac does is up to him. It is a result of his willing, in a way that the doings and occurrences of chameleons and tornadoes are not up to them. Indeed, it would be quite odd to say that the tornado was particularly destructive by accident, because there is no opposing sense in which the tornado could have been destructive on purpose. This is a kind of purpose, there's a kind of purpose to a chameleon's doings, but there's a sense in which that they do not do the things on purpose in the same way as human beings, or maybe even other higher animals. The difference between the chameleon's purposive doings and those of human beings, according to the standard approach, is accounted for by a special sort of psychological or mental act, an act of the will that occurs inside, as it were, the agent. In this context, the will is taken as a conscious deliberative power to weigh or evaluate distinct courses of action, which an ethical agent wields as the final determining factor in a decision. Notice that this conscious intention is supposed to play the final determining role in the bringing about of an ethically significant action. In short, the will and the freedom of the will debate is typically thought of as a sort of cause. At least part of why Cormack has done something ethically significant is that he has willed to perform some action in particular among the available options. It is then integral to this approach to ethical action that the act of the will occurs antecedently to the action. An exercise of the will is a conscious mental event that occurs prior to or simultaneously with the action it supposedly explains. That would seem to be the case necessarily because the common assumption in play is that ethically significant action is caused by the will, in much the same sense that the collision of a cue ball with an eight ball is the cause of the eight ball's subsequent residence in the corner pocket. The exercise of the will is supposed to be what brings about an ethically significant action, or what makes it such that the action occurs in the sense of a moving cause or an efficient cause of the subsequent chain of events that constitute a certain ethically significant action. Since the agent's exercise of the will is a cause, in that sense, of ethically significant actions, the exercise of the will certainly must be antecedent to the unfolding, or at least completion of the action. As the case of the eight ball's residence in the corner pocket, the cue ball striking of the eight ball must occur first in the order of time. PMS Hacker makes much the same point when he characterizes the received empiricist view, as he puts it, as a claim that, quote, some mental occurrence constitutes willing, and that willing causes the bodily movement, end quote. And thus, ethically significant action should be considered, quote, to be a movement caused by willing, and acting was causing the movement by the willing, end quote. At least that is what I take people standardly to have in mind with talk of the will as it relates to ethically significant actions. But we have not said anything about how all of this relates to freedom of the will. Many philosophers are apt to think that being an act of the will, even an act of the will that is an antecedent cause of an action, is not alone enough to constitute ethically significant action. What is needed is not just an exercise of the will, but a free exercise of the will. All along, we have said it must be up to Cormack to perform an action, if we are to either praise or blame him for doing so. Per the going account of its being up to Cormack, whether he performs a certain action is a question of an action's being caused by Cormack's willing that he do as much. But if the exercise of the will is not itself something Cormack does on purpose, then it is hard to see how we can say that his resulting action is not something he does accidentally. Thus, it would then seem that Cormack's exercise of his will must be free if it is going to ground ethically significant actions. That is, it must be up to him as to how he would exercise his will, in the sense that nothing else is making him do this. The debate over freedom of the will, at least in the mainstream of philosophy for the last few centuries, is over the cause of this cause. The question is whether the exercise of the will is itself caused by something outside of the agent, or whether the agent causes this act of the will independently of all external factors. The standard positions in the free will debate, whether libertarian, compatibilist, agent causal, hard determinist, etc., are all different accountings of the sense in which the will is or is not the efficient cause of our ethically significant actions independently of factors external to the agent. I am not interested in getting into which of the standard positions regarding freedom of the will is correct, because I believe they are all built on what I take to be a flawed assumption about our ethically significant actions. Moreover, I believe that these assumptions have caused the resulting understanding of ethical agency to pick an unnecessary fight with the results of neuroscience. My claim is not necessarily that there is no such thing as an act of the will in the sense I have admittedly caricatured it above, but more modestly that the standard line of philosophical thinking has placed the emphasis in the wrong place. This misguided emphasis on what counts for ethical agency lends itself to undue skepticism about our status as free beings, and subsequent misunderstandings regarding what is most important in our lives. By neuroskeptic, I will mean someone who denies that we have freedom of the will based on the supposed implications of neuroscientific findings. And in recent years, there have been no small number of such free will deniers addressing both academic and popular audiences. The evidence provided by neuroscience that the neuroskeptic appeals to varies, but I will focus on what has likely become the most infamous. In 1964, two German scientists, Hans Helmut Kornhuber, maybe one of the best German names ever, by the way, okay, and Luder Dicke, set out to investigate the degree to which the brain is actively involved in decision-making processes. To that end, they conducted an experiment in which human subjects were asked to tap with one of their fingers at whatever interval they chose, while any changes in the level of brain activity were recorded. Dicke and Kornhuber found that there was indeed a spike in brain activity leading up to the subject's finger tapping. They called this increased activity in the subject's brains the readiness potential, and they interpreted it as the nervous system's preparation to bring about an action. Benjamin Libet picked up where Dicke and Kornhuber left off, and he was particularly intrigued by the fact that there is a lag between the gathering of the readiness potential and the actual downstream movement. It is not a big gap, a micro fraction of a second, but in neurological terms, where things are measured at the speed of electricity, this is a pretty significant interval. Why is there a substantial gap in time between the decision to act and the subsequent activity? Libet looked into this by having human subjects use a sort of clock, this is very simplifying, to record when they consciously decided to move their finger, while their brains were simultaneously being monitored for the onset of the readiness potential. To make a very long story short, the incredible result that Libet found was that the subject's conscious sense of their decision occurred, though only by a tiny fraction of a second, after the buildup of the readiness potential. That is incredible, as it shows that the brain has already, in some sense, decided to perform the action before the subject's conscious sense of having made a decision. The conscious part of the decision seems to then to be after the fact, so it plays no role in determining what will eventually happen. The experience of free will, as it were, is just as much an effect of the realization of the readiness potential as the actual physical movement. Remember the shared assumption of the contemporary free will debate. Ethically significant action must be caused by an agent's exercise of the will. Where an exercise of the will is antecedently occurring, or at least simultaneous, resolution to deliberation among the available options. Libertarians, hard determinists, and compatibilists, whatever their other disagreements, all agree that antecedent conscious deliberation is a necessary condition for morally significant actions, because such an action must, in one sense or another, be free, and free actions must be caused by the conscious will. Libet's experiment, however, seems to show that the conscious act of willing is not antecedent to the readiness potential, and it is therefore not the cause of the action. The threat to freedom and moral agency does not come from the plausibility of determinism or the implausibility of compatibilism or libertarianism. Rather, the problem is that the will does not seem to do any significant work in causing our activities. All the real work seems to be done by neurological activity that is itself antecedent to our supposed acts of will. Though Libet is likely the most influential, a number of other researchers have arrived at similar results. For example, C.S. Soon and collaborators were able to predict subjects' decisions before they themselves were consciously aware of it with a 60% reliability using fMRI. Daniel Wegner, a social psychologist, appeals to an array of experiments wherein subjects were tricked into thinking they have or have not consciously willed to do something, which would again seem to show that it is not the conscious will that is really running things. There is no small amount of properly scientific along with philosophical controversy about these experiments and their interpretation. Serious questions have been raised regarding whether they really do support the philosophical conclusions neuroskeptics infer from them on scientific grounds. I will not wade into those waters here. Not because I doubt there is anything to worry about in that vicinity, though. I am nevertheless happy to concede that the Leibniz-style scientists and the neuroskeptical philosophers interpreting their results have in fact shown that their subjects were not acting freely, despite their own conscious sense of having done so. I do not find that terribly troubling, because as I shall argue now, ethical agency that is really worth having has very little to do with anything going on in these experiments. In fact, I believe that Leibniz-style experiments do the proponent of a bona fide capacity for ethically significant actions on the part of human beings a service by disabusing us, finally, of a wrong-headed way of framing our self-understandings. There are three very important facts about the neuroskeptical case that we need to focus on in order to understand the philosophical implications of the scientific evidence they appeal to. The actions, and I'm even reluctant to call them actions, that the subjects perform in the Leibniz-style experiments are arbitrary, insignificant, and episodic. By arbitrary, I mean that the performances in the Leibniz-style experiments are not what recent philosophers call reasons sensitive. That is, they are not doings that can be rationally justified. When asked to tap your finger at any interval of your choosing, without being given any further end this interval tapping might serve, your decision for one interval over another is not something for which you can give a reason. Supposing Cormac were a subject to the Leibniz-style experiment, when asked why he tapped his finger at any given moment as opposed to any other moment in the infinity of perfectly good moments at which he might have tapped, there is no reason he could give for that. He could only cite a brute fact. That's just what I chose to do. Maybe Cormac could offer, "I want to be a good experimental participant," or some such claim to explain why he is doing any finger tapping at all. But notice that the Leibniz experiment is not aimed at rooting out the antecedent causes of his finger tapping in general, but his finger tapping at one interval instead of all the other possibilities. For that explanation, it would seem that Cormac could only say, "Well, that's just what I happen to pick." Notice, however, that "I chose it" or "I choose it" might be a cause of acting, but is not a reason for acting. If I were to ask Cormac, "Why did you leave for swim practice early today?" and he replies, "Because I chose to leave early," I would point out to him that he really has not answered my question. This is a real event, by the way. Of course, he chose to do so. Of course he chose to do so. That is why I'm asking him why he left early. If he had not decided the matter, I wouldn't be asking him why he did it. I wanted to know why he did it, not the causal process that led up to or finalized the decision. Typically, a reason for acting is an end that the agent aims to achieve by such an action. If Cormac were to answer my question with, "So that I could get some extra laps in for my breaststroke," or "So that I could goof around in the pool with the other guys," whatever I might think of the relative worth of the different justifications for his actions, either of these replies provides an intelligible reason for acting. That is, they tell us to what end he thought he was moving toward when he left for practice early. Notice that tapping your finger at some random interval is not reason sensitive in that way. The performance is arbitrary in that it serves no end, and an agent acting in such a way can offer no meaningful justification. Notice that a reason for acting is typically an end that would plausibly justify such an action, which is to say that reasons for acting are taken as goods that the agent expects or hopes will be brought about by such acting. This emphasis on the notion of reasons as goods highlights the insignificance of the performances of the subjects in the Leibniz-style experiments. I take it that only ends that can be seen as being significant to us are intelligible explanations of actions. To say that I acted to achieve some end implies that such an end is a good to me. As Aristotle opens what is likely the most historically influential discussion of ethically significant action in the Western tradition, quote, "Every action in deliberative choice must seek some good," end quote. Certainly a condition of something being a good to me is that it is something I care about, or it contributes to something I care about. In other words, when I ask Cormac, "Why did you do that?" I am looking for reasons, not merely the causes for his actions, and only ends of acting that have significance to him would serve as a plausible answer to that question. So that I can get extra laps for my breaststroke, or so that I can goof around in the pool with the other guys, serve as reasons for Cormac's early departure, because we can understand these states of affairs as goods or contributing to goods he is likely to care about, becoming a better swimmer, or fun with the buddies. If Cormac replied to my query about his early departure by saying, well, I just wanted the minute hand on the clock to point to 6 instead of 9 as I walked through the door, I would need some broader explanation as to why the position of the minute hand could possibly matter to him enough as to warrant some particular course of acting before I could see the part, see that as part of the actual explanation. A correct follow-up to such a reply would be the further question. How can you possibly care about that? Maybe the position of the minute hand really was what motivated Cormac, but I would point out that such a concern is not a good reason for acting at all. In fact, it's merely arbitrary, and doing so renders his act insignificant. Ethical agency requires a certain maturity about what counts as a real concern. The citation of the end the agent doesn't really care about, or shouldn't care about so much, leaves the real explanation of the action opaque, or it reveals that the doing was falling short of a bona fide action at all. Notice that in the Leavitt-style experiments, the finger-tapping performances of the subjects are quite insignificant to them. It is hard to believe that any subject cared about which moment she tapped her finger as opposed to any other of the infinity of moments she might have tapped. If similar exercises of finger tapping were involved in an Olympic event in digital dexterity, there would be a ready-to-hand reasons explanation. Nevertheless, under the experimental conditions, nothing is at stake in which arbitrarily chosen moment you tap your finger. And so there is no significant reasons explanation to be given of those moments. One then has to strain to call these finger tappings actions in any meaningful sense. Finally, the performances in the Leavitt-style experiments are episodic, in the sense that the decision leading up to them takes place in a discrete, clockable moment. That is, we are dealing with events that can be shown to have occurred at a specific time, or at least during a definite hard-edged interval. The subject in the Leavitt-style experiment were clocked at the exact time, or nearly so, at which they thought they consciously made the decision to tap their finger. Likewise, the readiness potential was detected at a definite time. Both the conscious perception of the decision and the neurophysiological activity were timed down to the fraction of the second. It is only because the decision to act in these cases can be precisely characterized as a discrete episode that we are concerned with which event, the conscious episode or the neurophysiological episode, comes first. Since the decision to tap your finger arbitrarily and insignificantly is a discrete episode, it makes sense to look for its cause among other discrete episodes. A necessary condition of one discrete episode explaining another is that the one doing the causing comes first or simultaneously in time. For this reason, the Leavitt-style experiment takes the conscious episode and the neurophysiological episode in a sort of competition for who goes first, wherein the winner is the real, so to speak, decision responsible for the subsequent finger tapping. Now, I am not concerned whether Leavitt-style experiments show that conscious volitions are in fact epiphenomenal cases of arbitrary, insignificant, and episodic decisions to act. In fact, I would expect that organisms, even rational and reflective organisms like us, would have a mechanism wherein they could determine actions in an arbitrary way on a split second's notice. There is not a lot of time for neat reasoned sensitivity when the saber-toothed tiger shows up on the prehistoric plains of sub-Saharan Africa. It is better to do something rather than nothing in such a situation. Even running in an arbitrarily chosen direction ups your chances of not getting eaten better than remaining stationary while wrought with indecision. Or at least you might distract the predator from cherished kin who are lucky enough to pick a safer direction of retreat. True that may be, but how relevant is that sort of activity to ethically significant action? Is that how we operate in the really important moments in our lives? Are those the sorts of judgments we labor to prepare our children to make? Take, for example, my decision to marry Jennifer. Was that decision arbitrary? Hardly. I could cite many reasons rendering the course of action perfectly rational, even impeccably justified. A decision to marry a particular person is certainly something we would expect to be reason sensitive in this way. This decision had the highest significance to me because it was a consequence of, and partly constituent of my commitment to a form of life, a way of living. We see this kind of decision as important or grave because it plays that sort of life-defining role. A decision gains ethical significance in part due to the fact that it reflects a commitment to a particular vision of what counts as the good life. Ethically significant actions aim at goods that matter to us because of their role in what we take as defining ourselves by what we most cherish. Such actions either define our notions of the good life. Because I have married you, I am hereby committed to a host of other activities so broad as to define the kind of life I will now live with you. Or they are important consequences of our already held existential commitments. Because I have a broad commitment to a certain form of life, I am now committing myself to marrying you. In most cases, our ethically significant actions are done out of a mix of these two directions of commitment. That is why such decisions stand out as having ethical significance. They define our character or commit us to a certain interpretation of what is most worth caring about. Further notice that the decision to marry Jennifer was not episodic. There was no one clockable moment at which I can say I made this decision through a conscious act of will. Or at least I am not aware of when such a moment occurred, nor was I when it supposedly did occur. In such decisions, there is rarely, if ever, that eureka moment when one decides all at once to go forward with some course of action. It is often much more like finding oneself in a state of having resolved to take a certain course. There was no specific day and time in the winter of the year 2000 at which I decided to marry Jennifer, though I know sometime in that vicinity I crossed the threshold. No doubt there were many millions of discrete events, both mental and physical, whirling around in my vicinity during those months. Nevertheless, just as the addition of no one drop of rainfall marks the end of a drought, no one of those episodes amounted to making the decision. There is a fact of the matter, all things being equal, as to whether or not there was a drought last summer in western Kansas, but it is inherently vague when specified down to the drop what quantity of water would have remedied the situation. It is odd to think that a single milliliter of water marks the difference, but that has no bearing on whether there really is or is not a drought. Likewise, it might be inherently vague as to when I make a decision, but that does not call into doubt that I made the decision. I think if you reflect on most of the really important decisions you have made in your life, the ones with the greatest ethical significance, the resolutions that have done the most to define or confirm who you are, you will mostly find that there was no discrete moment of decision, but a sort of finding oneself in a commitment after a process of deliberation. In my experience, one usually admits to himself what he has already seemingly resolved to do. Ethically significant actions follow on commitments to courses that we have already been through. Excuse me. Ethically significant actions follow on commitments to ways of life that we have already been thrown into by our understanding of what is most worthy in being human. Maybe there are ethically significant decisions occurring at discrete moments, and I'm not quite sure how we could sort all that out. But my point is only that prior temporal discreteness is not a necessary condition for ethically significant action. The temporal ambiguity of ethically significant action, ethically significant decision making, or at least some of it, brings us to the final salient feature of morally significant actions. Morally significant actions, by definition, are reason sensitive. But notice that they are often, maybe most often, only sensitive to reasons retrospectively. As Alistair McIntyre puts it, quote, that it is only in the course of the movement that the goals of the movement are articulated is the reason why we can understand human affairs only after the event, end quote. In other words, often the reasons for taking some of the most important actions in our lives, those that most define our commitments to a conception of the good life, are not entirely transparent to me while I am making those decisions or performing those actions. The full reasons for an action, the significant goods that justify it, are often only available to us consciously well after the fact. It is only subsequent to the performance that our reasons can now be seen as justified. Thus, we can be responsible for something, maybe even something of the highest ethical significance, but our reasons committing us to this responsibility might only be explicit to us retrospectively. Indeed, it is perfectly reasonable for us to take our reasons from others, say a wise counsel from a trusted friend, even when what makes those considerations good reasons is not entirely transparent to us. In such cases, it seems perfectly reasonable to accept full responsibility for the actions that are justified by those currently opaque reasons. Aristotle points out that even the wisest among us, quote, call upon partners in deliberation on important matters when we mistrust ourselves as not being adequate to determine the answer, end quote. That, however, means that the reasons justifying my actions, actions for which I am responsible, may be beyond my grasp as reasons when I actually perform those actions. Once again, my decision to marry Jennifer is just such a case. Though that decision is perfectly justified by the reasons available, and I can now understand those reasons as justifying that decision, those very same reasons were not entirely transparent to me in the winter of 2000. In fact, though they were maybe quite opaque to me then, two decades later, they are far clearer. Indeed, I suspect, God willing, those reasons will be even more apparent to me in two more decades. The reasons for my decision to marry Jennifer were not strictly internal to me, but had much to do with my occupying a certain place in human history, both an institutional history and a history of the particularities of my life and the lives of others with whom I share caring relationships. Making those reasons explicit has been an incremental process supervening on a 20-year-long project of living a certain form of life, which is still open-ended and ongoing. At this late date, I can make many of those reasons for my marital commitment explicit, even though I doubt I was really consciously aware of any of that 20 years ago. But that is not to say that those reasons were not there in the world as I was thrown into it and took responsibility for it with that decision two decades ago. In fact, that I can cite such reasons retrospectively is some reason to conclude that they were indeed operative back then. As McIntyre puts it, quote, "It is because any exercise of the power to reflect on our reasons for action presupposes that we already have such reasons about which we can reflect prior to our reflection," end quote. Our reflection on our reasons, our conscious explicit making of them, is not constitutive of our reasons, but presupposes that those reasons are already there independently of our act of reflection. Bob the Chameleon's reasons for the particularities of this morning's hunt were there operating for him, even though he was not reflecting on them, nor will he ever do so. Thus, I do not need to reflect on something for it to be my reason for acting. The point here is that our most significant actions, the sorts of decisions we are raising our children to be able to make, the justifying reasons for those decisions may not, or usually are not, explicitly and completely available to us until after the fact. In short, reason sensitivity, in the reflectively significant sense, is mostly retrospective. As a rational animal, I should be on the hunt to make my reasons explicit, but that is mostly done looking back to what I have already done when I know better what I was really up to. My reasons for marrying Jennifer were carried for me by my participation in a certain family, a certain education, a church. But those were my reasons because those institutions were constitutive of the form of life that I live, whether I liked it or not, right? Though at the time, very little of all that was explicitly crossed my mind. The owl Minerva does indeed make its most important flights late in the day. Notice that the sorts of ethically significant decisions you are tasked with at this stage of your life, or soon hereabout, are predicated on judgments mostly above your current pay grade. How can someone really know what a marital commitment entails without actually having lived the married life? I suspect a religious vocation is no different, nor is the decision to join the Marines or some such. Right? All of these ask you to make commitments to forms of life only justifiable by reasons beyond your explicit grasp until you've gotten pretty far down that road. Should you one day be blessed to raise children, you will need to make decisions about their education and health for reasons that can only be really understood retrospectively, maybe decades after the fact. Ethically significant decision-making is as much about participation in traditions and institutions, marriage, family, profession, order, service branch, as it is about our explicit reflections or acts of will. Most of our important decisions are matters of taking up what has been passed to us, rather than some sort of free radical choice exercised in our moral privacy. Of course, we are rational beings who can at times, and usually only as the hard-won fruits of the wisdom of experience, make our reasons explicit. I take it that this ability, not only to act for reasons, but to further make those reasons explicit, to ask ourselves whether those reasons are in fact good reasons for acting, and ultimately to amend our actions when we answer such questions negatively, is what constitutes our distinctive human freedom. Bob the Chameleon never asks himself, is there a better way to catch these crickets? Or what the hell is the point of all this hunting in the grand scheme of the universe anyway? Notice, however, that the reflective space of meta-reasoning is not where we begin, normally function, or even do our most gravely important work. Our lot is one of dependency. We depend on the implicit presence of the reasons for our actions in the world that we accept. The threat, then, to our status as ethical agents does not, then, come from the sorts of neuroscientific findings produced by the Leibniz-style experiments. Rather, it is the undermining of the traditions and institutions on which we piggyback for our reasons in the most crucial junctures of our lives. Or when those institutions and traditions are in good order, we are threatened by the malfunction of our relationship to such institutions and traditions. In the two sequels to this lecture, I will discuss two such malfunctions. The fact that humans are subject to certain sorts of distorting self-deceptions, and our perennial temptation to indulge illusions of control exasperated by our modern technological attitude. Thank you.